You may be seated there where you are, and that is our breath, and it is our life. It's our greatest heart's desire. I want to invite you to grab your copy of God's Word as we journey back to the book of James today. And his book, James, the brother of Jesus, really lays out for us what the faith looks like in flesh. What our faith really looks like in flesh. In reality, my faith is invisible. But the way I live my life is very visible. And so James, the brother of Jesus, says, here's what an internal faith looks like if it is lived out visibly very well. And over the last couple of weeks, we've been looking at what James has had to talk about. James, the brother of Jesus, has already told us how we deal with trials, how we deal with temptations. He talked about the vital relationship between faith and works. Last week, we said, James said that it's really important as God's children as how we use our tongue. And I gave you a challenge. How many of you remember the challenge last week? Here was the challenge, all right? Let me remind you of it if you don't remember it from last week. Here was our commitment together. It says, this week I will not use my tongue destructively to gossip, insult someone, lie about someone, or please my own ego by using my tongue to tear someone down. That was our commitment number one. Number two, I will use my tongue positively only to encourage, praise, or even tell the truth, even if it hurts me, in order to build others up. Number three, this week, this is the commitment we made last week, I will use my tongue to witness to someone else by sharing the gospel with them or inviting someone to church or offering to pray for someone else. Number four was this, this week, before I say anything, I will ask myself, is what I'm about to say true? Is it necessary that I say it? Is it beneficial to those who I'm saying it to? Do I have permission to share what I know? And then number five, is my motive pure? And then the next one was simply this, I make a commitment to come back next week and be honest about how I did. So let me ask you a question. Be honest. How many of you, when it comes to the way you used your tongue last week, how many of you, if you were going to put a letter grade on how you use your tongue, you made an A? You made an A. Be honest. You can be honest. If you think you made an A. All right, we got one, I think. I want you to know y'all are a lot harder graders than the 9:30 service. Let me be honest. There's a bunch of them that think they're spiritual giants, and they're not. How many of you honest think you made a B? You made it. Yeah, I'll give myself a B. I see some of y'all have a B minus. Here's what a B minus looks like. B plus, B, B minus. All right. How many of you, you're gonna say I'm a solid C? The way I used my tongue was a solid C last week. How many of you, you roared in with a D? D? How many of you flat out flunked? Yeah, it's funny. I already had someone say today, golly, I walked out of here saying I was going to take that challenge, and it's hard. I had forgotten how much. That's what James is all about. Sometimes we forget how much our tongue just is used to wear people out. I will also tell you that always on a given Sunday, after I leave the service, people are leaving at different paces and different rates, and I stand around, talk to people and encourage people and whatever else. By the time I picked up my phone, I had four or five text messages of people saying, my husband did not even make it out of the parking lot. David Meyer. I had other people say, man, I didn't do it. I got a great one Sunday afternoon, and they're in here. They're in this service. And it was this. The family couldn't make it to church. They were out last week. So the whole family gathered around our online. If you didn't look, about last week we had 776 people viewing online. If you multiply that by usually at least two people watching, it's another 1,400, 1,500 people that are viewing online right now. For those of you who viewed online, you're probably looking for Will Chapman, who's always online. He was actually on keyboard today, so that's why you had another host online. Will is so multi-talented. But Sunday afternoon, we get a message from a family that they had viewed the service online, and as a family, they had taken the test. They had taken the one-week challenge, and I believe this is exactly the way the story is. Where is Kylie at? She's right down here. Get up and raise your hand, Kylie. Raise it higher, Kylie. All right. She's second grade. All right, and I believe the story. I'm going to translate the story as best I can. Dad was helping with homework. Is that correct? Okay. Now I want you to know, if you want me to fail a test, you let me help my kids with homework. And in the process, she wasn't getting it as quickly as he thought she should. And he said something a little harsh. And she called him out. She said, "Dad, you have already flunked Pastor John Mark's test, and it's still Sunday." You go, girl. Now, here's the funny part. To try to defend himself, he followed up a text, "Don't I at least get bonus points for having my second grader so focused online that she actually was paying attention by the end?" I'm not sure that there wasn't another fail in there. But so how did you do? It's hard. We talked about the tongue last week. Here's another one. Why all the quarreling and fighting? That's what James asks. Why do we fight and quarrel all the time? Let's look at what James chapter 4 has to say as we look at verse 1 to 3. Let's put it up on the screen. James just asked some questions. What causes fights and quarrels among you? He says, "Don't they come from the desires that battle within you? You desire, but you do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask, but when you do ask," he says, you don't receive because you ask with the wrong motives, "that you may spend what you get on yourself." He's honest. He says a lot of the reason that we don't get what we ask for from God because we ask with the wrong motives. So as we talk about this passage, and we've had the opportunity to receive the Lord's Supper, so I want to move through this, but I want you to know that our quarreling and fighting can be incredibly detrimental, not only in our own marriages and families we're going to look at and in our own lives, but beyond that, to our witness and our opportunity as a church and as believers and as Christians to reach out with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I really want to look today, and hopefully as we walk through that, I want to give you four questions and answers as they relate to quarrels and as they relate to fighting. Question number one, what is the source of our arguments? Why do we fight? Why do we argue? What is the source of our arguments and our feuds? Here's what he says. Look at it in James chapter 4, verse 1. He identifies the source. Are we ready? James chapter 4, verse 1. We'll go with this one. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? What is he saying? Where is the source of my quarreling? Most of the time, when we get in an argument in a fight with somebody, and someone else asks us what happened, what do we want to do? Well, they did this, right? Isn't that normally where we point when we're talking about a fight or an argument or a quarrel with someone, right? James flips it over. He says, to be real honest, your quarreling and your fighting happens from right in here. It comes from the inside out. not from the outside in. So notice what it says, James chapter 4, verse 1. He says, what's the source? What's the cause of our fights and quarrels that are among you? Now notice he says, among you. Specifically, certainly we understand there's quarreling and fighting outside of the community of faith and the believers. But James is saying, why do believers fight? Why do we argue with each other? Why do we quarrel with each other? Why are we bitter with each other? Why are we angry with each other? He says, what is the source? So he says, among you, plural. He would be asking us today, he goes, what is your problem with that person right there? Or your problem with that person over here? He's talking to us. A lot of times we like to export these messages. What's the definition of a good sermon? It's one that flies right over your head and hits the person right behind you. Man, we love to sit in here. Boy, Pastor, you start railing on the sin of this country. You start railing on the politicians. You start railing. James says, hey, listen, before we rail on them, let's talk about us. And if you are in here and you are harboring angry feelings or bitterness or quarrels with someone else in here, James says, want to know what the source is? He says, they come from your own desire that battles within you. That word desire is the Greek word hedone. It's the Greek word we get our English word hedonism from. Hedonism. We all think, when we think of hedonism, what do we think? Hedonism, by definition, means the desire to please my own flesh. My own flesh. So everything I want to do. Now, granted, most of us, especially as believers and Christians, when we think of hedonism, what do we think? Some crazy wild sin, right? Some sin of excess. Vegas or Amsterdam or some crazy hedonistic sin that only pleases self. In its original language, it became that word in its original language. It just talks about a desire. That I have a desire within me for something. To be pleased or to do something. And so what James says is our quarreling, even among church people, and our fighting, even among church people, comes from right in here, a desire that I have. Church is split. Life groups split. Friendships split because someone has a desire that goes unmet. Sometimes it's split over music or color of carpet or version that the pastor preaches about or something, or someone accidentally did something to you and your flesh was hurt and it was a desire. Man, it is real. I want you to know, just because we're believers doesn't mean that every feeling, every emotion that you and I have is from God. I want you to know that. And I know a lot of times there are people that say, well, you know what? They'll come up and they'll say, well, you know what? I feel like God's told me this. Let me be honest with you. When someone comes up to me and says that, or you or someone else, and says, leads with God told me, that's pretty much the end of the story. Because I don't argue with God. Now, I can question whether that's your desire or God's desire. But man, when you lead with God told me this, we have to be real careful. As we examine our own desires and those things that I want, what's God's heartbeat and what's my heartbeat? Remember what Paul said in Romans chapter 7? In Romans chapter 7, Paul put it this way. He says, for I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that is, in my sinful nature. What is Paul saying? Romans chapter 7, he says, man, in me, and let me tell you what, when I grade, you're talking about grade, Paul would be an A plus in my book. And I'm compared to him, I'm an F mediocre. But Paul's honest. Paul's saying, listen, there are desires in me, in my sinful nature, that cause me not to do what I want to do, but then also cause me to do the very thing that I don't want to do. And that's that word hedone. It's that Greek word hedone. My own desires. So don't think, listen, don't think that your desires and my desires don't play a part in creating quarrels and fights and arguing. So what's the source? It's in here, it's not out there. Number two, second question, you ready? How do our selfish desires affect our relationships? How do our selfish desires, the internal selfish desires, affect our relationships? Well, let's go back to James chapter 4, verse 2. He says, you desire, there's the Greek word, but you do not have. So what do? You kill. Now listen, he's exaggerating to make a point. He's not saying that every time you don't get what you desire, you go kill someone, right? That's not what he's saying. He's exaggerating. I remember as a kid, anybody, your dad ever make this statement? My dad used to always say this phrase. Usually it was after I got caught doing something, and dad would say something like, why did you do it? And I go, I don't know, which was true. I don't know. We were just all doing it. And my dad would oftentimes say something like this. Well, if all of your friends jumped off a bridge, would you go jump off a bridge? In my entire growing up life, I don't remember one of my friends jumping off a bridge. However, had they done it, there's a good possibility I'd have jumped off a bridge. Right? So he's exaggerating. He's not saying every time you desire something that you don't get, you kill someone. He's saying, listen, here's what happens. What do? You don't kill them physically. What did Jesus talk about killing someone in my heart? Oh, I could kill them. And then a lot of times we let a word out, we begin to assassinate their character and kill their character. And he says, you covet, listen to our relationship, you covet and you do not get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. Listen, what happens? What do these selfish desires and how do they affect our relationship? We become jealous, write this down. We become envious, angry, and here's the last word, violent. Boy, if we don't stop jealousy at its root, it becomes envy. If it's envy, then it becomes angry. And then if it's not angry, it becomes violence all the way down the path. Probably the greatest biblical example, particularly in the Old Testament, of jealousy, envy, ultimately moving towards anger and violence, is probably the story of Joseph in Genesis chapter 37. Remember what it says? We all know the story. But you may have missed the part in Genesis chapter 37, verse 11, that the whole reason that this downhill spiral in the relationship with Joseph and his brother started was over one thing, jealousy. It says his brothers were jealous of him. What were they jealous of? They were jealous because Joseph was the favored son of Jacob. They knew it. Joseph knew it. Everybody knew it. And so as we read Genesis chapter 37, it says they looked up and saw Joseph coming. What did the other brothers want? They wanted to be the favored son. Boy, and another good thought here. Listen, a lot of times, even if you got what you wanted, you wouldn't get what you wanted. What did they want? They wanted the favored son out of the way so they could become the favored son. Well, let me ask you, go read through Scripture. Which one of them became the favored son? Nada. They didn't get what they wanted. They didn't end up getting what they desired. It says their jealousy, his brothers were jealous of him. And a lot of times we need to understand that, listen, our relationships are affected negatively because of our jealousy and envy, and if it's not restrained or if it's not dealt with, it becomes anger and ultimately it can become violence. Here's the third question. How do our selfish desires affect our relationship with God? They affect our relationship with others. We get jealous and angry. In Joseph's case, it destroyed the family. They eventually ended up back together, but only by the grace of God. And let me tell you what, his father and his father lived with grief all of his life, and his brothers lived with guilt. Boy, what we can glean from that story about how to live a righteous life pales in comparison to what we can glean from that story about what happens when brothers and sisters and whatever else, husbands and wives, get jealous and angry with each other. How do our selfish desires affect our relationship with God? So we move from where is the source in here? How does it affect our relationship with others, quarrels and fighting? How does it affect my relationship with God, my hedonism, my personal hedonism? Look at what James says, James chapter 4, verse 2. And there's a logical connection here in the syntax and the original language from verse 2 to verse 3. Here's what he says. He says, you do not have because you do not ask God. In other words, when I look at something that I'm jealous or envious about or angry about for someone else, he says, you don't have because you don't ask God. What do you ask God? God? Not just simply, God, can I have one of those? I don't know about you. My neighbor rolls up in a red Corvette. I might think, God, could I have one of those? No, it's more when you see someone else elevated or someone else has a position, you step back and say, God, is that something you would desire for me to have? So that's a different question. Then he goes on and he says, but when you do ask, you do not receive. Why wouldn't we receive? Because our relationship with God is affected because of our jealousy and envy and anger and violence. He says, you do not receive because you ask with the wrong motives. Uh-oh. So you mean there are a lot of things that I don't get from God because I ask with the wrong motives? Absolutely. What is the wrong motive? That you may spend what you get on your pleasures. Let me ask you a question. How often when you pray and ask God for a promotion or ask God for a raise or ask God for this, how often do you pray that you would so you could use it for yourself or you could use it for others? If you wanted the elevated position, not just finances, how often do you say, God, I would love for you to give me this position so that the greater opportunity for witness I might have could take place if I got the promotion? Or do we instead pray, God, I might give you a little more if you'd give me a whole lot more? That's usually the prayer we pray. God, give me this position, give me this, give me that. Man, why? Because we want to use it on ourselves. Here's the fourth thought and question. You ready? What are the consequences of arguing and fighting with those of us here, those in your family? Thought number one, are you ready for it? First, it harms our families. Write that down. It harms our families. Man, when we struggle and when we hurt and when we argue, it harms our families. Look at Proverbs chapter 15, verse 17. It says, better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to know what that means. You can almost picture a couple sitting there and big long table and everything, the china is out and everything and the prime rib and lobster rolls on and you got two angry people sitting there just looking at each other and they're angry and bitter. Contrast with a little hut. A couple or a family loves each other and sitting there eating some vittles. Just munching on some vegetables, but there's love and not bitterness and hatred. What about the other passage, Luke chapter 15, talking about hurting our families? Verse 28 says, the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. Many of you might know Luke chapter 15. Oh, yeah. Story of the prodigal son. Remember the story of the prodigal son? You may not remember this verse. We all know the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son was one, although he was eventually going to get it all. Anyway, he went to his dad and says, Dad, I know normally it's tradition that we wait until you die before we ask for our inheritance, but I want it now. his dad, being gracious, goes ahead and says, all right, well, son, this is kind of odd. This is unique, but I'm going to go ahead and take out, and I'm going to divide up my kingdom. I'm going to give you your portion. Remember, that prodigal son takes off, and he spends it on himself. So much so that he finds himself in a pigsty, in a pig slop, looking at the corn and looking at the food that the pigs were eating. And he goes, how many of my father's servants eat better than I do? As a result, he said, I'm going to go back to my father. I'm going to ask him to forgive me. And so, man, the father looks up and he sees the prodigal son as the prodigal son returns home. And the father looks up, and as they get in there, he says, listen, go throw a party. My prodigal is coming home. Remember, they throw a big party, a celebration of grace of the Father, the Heavenly Father. And what happens? The brother who stayed is mad. And he refuses to go into the party. And so the father, who has lovingly received his prodigal back, has to go outside to try and console the son who is mad. And notice what it says. It says the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So the father had to go out and plead with him. Man, it harms our marriages and our families and sibling rivalry. I ran across a study, several studies I won't share with them, but I have them here. One was in the Science of People, and it was about marriages. That in couples that fight all the time, about 69% of the arguments a couple has is the same argument over and over and over again. Unresolved conflict. Think about it in your life and in your marriage. Here's what that means. Is that means that something happens in a marriage, I don't know, may have happened a long time ago, and all of a sudden you realize after you married him, he's actually not perfect. He's not a neat freak. As a matter of fact, he's an unneat freak. And so you begin to share with him and you begin to talk to him about it, and he's totally untrainable. And you start having the argument, you start having the fight, and you start having this, and you start having that. Basically, what this article says is that for those who argue a lot, 69% of the arguments a couple is having today was essentially the same couple argument they were having yesterday and the day before and the day before and the day before. Is that the way it is in your life? Here was the point of the article. It's like a wound that just as it begins to scab over, the sun comes back up and one of you reaches it and tears it back off. Same argument over and over again. One of the real good things that Gene and I did years ago in our marriage, and neither one of us are perfect, and I will tell you, of any of the two of us, she is way, way closer than I am. But we made a decision early on in our relationship that we weren't going to fight about much because not much was worth fighting about. And we definitely were not going to go around making mountains out of molehills. And that has really freed me up to throw my clothes all over the closet. I mean, that's the way it is. If your marriage is struggling because you're constantly at each other's throat, let me put it in perspective for you. There's really only a couple of things worth fighting about. And I probably don't need to list them for you. Everything else, small stuff. Let it heal. Let it be over. Not only do they harm our marriages and our families, also a different study that I read this week is that those kids that grow up in homes where the couples argue and fight verbally and physically, their self-esteem here compared to a child's self-esteem who grew up in a home that knew how to resolve conflicts in a civil way. they harm our friendships. They harm our friendships. Man, quarreling and arguing and fighting, it not only harms my relationship with the person I'm arguing with, but my friendship, those around us, man, those who also roll around. Look at this. The disciples who were friends, the disciples argued about who would be the greatest, who would sit at the right and the left hand of Jesus, and Peter and Paul argued about hypocrisy over and over again. Man, believers, if we are not careful, we will argue and destroy and tear down. He's talking about us. Man, the disciples did it. Can you imagine? Jesus has just walked on water. He's fed the 5,000. And two of the brothers say, hey, can one of us sit on your left and one of us sit on the right? Can you imagine what the rest of the disciples immediately, the nerve of them. But it not only destroys when I argue and fight with somebody, it not only destroys my relationship with them, it destroys and harms my relationship with my friends around because they then have to choose sides. One of my favorite recent historical characters is Winston Churchill. If you know anything about Winston Churchill, you know he had a legendary battle with Nancy Astor, Lady Astor. Winston Churchill was the prime minister of Britain, and Nancy Astor was the first female elected to the British House of Commons, the Parliament. And something was said sometime that they got into bitter arguments and quarrels, and they never let it go. There was one instance early on, and some believe it was this statement that started it all. That she was at one of these big dog parties, political parties, and the prime minister, Winston Churchill, was drunk, and he was drunk. And she sneeringly looked at him and said, Sir Winston, you are drunk. And he drunkenly responded to her and said, Yes, ma'am, you are correct, I am drunk. But in the morning, I will be sober, you will still be ugly. Before you judge too hard, I've seen a picture and he was right. All the facts of the case, totally right. I don't know if that was the one that started it, but let me tell you what, ladies, how many of you know, it is never over after that. Guys, note to self, it's never over. There was another time when he's actually given an official, and you've seen it, from time to time I'll get sucked in, I'll be going through the political stations, and they'll have this, the House of Commons. Have you ever seen that? Where they just kind of scream at each other? That's kind of a cool deal. You think our political, you know, what do we do? A president gives the State of the Union speech at a certain point. One group on this side stands up and the other group does this. And then they'll all stand up because they know we need their votes. And then they'll all, you know, that's the way. And they just start talking. And this is in the middle of an official State Union speech. He says something that just sets her off. And Lady Astor, Nancy Astor says, Sir Winston, if you were my husband, I would flavor your coffee with poison. Ever ready, he responded, Ma'am, if I was your husband, I would drink it. Okay, that's funny now. But what's interesting, if you read the memoirs of those who were surrounded and constantly in those relationships, they talked about when the two of them were together, the energy was sapped out of the room. Because you knew when you walked into the room with him and her, you had to choose sides. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Anybody ever walked in and, man, you don't really have a problem with somebody, but you know so-and-so has a problem with somebody. And you want to be careful not to do anything that can be what? Misinterpreted as you choosing sides. And then usually what happens, how many of you have noticed this? In those situations, there's usually one that is grading everybody else around to make sure everybody was choosing sides. And the side they had better choose was what? Theirs. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Man, it can harm our friendships. But it's not just our families that quarreling and feuding harms, not just our marriages because we continue to rip the blister off and rip the scab off, not just our kids because it kills their self-esteem, not just our kids because kids that grow up fighting and quarreling and arguing in the wrong way end up producing and reproducing a house that fights and quarrels. Not only that, it can destroy our friendships. If you want to end up isolated and alone, you always make your friends choose sides between you and someone else. I'm just telling you, you'll end up alone. You'll always have a friend, but they will be always be, listen to this, and I don't want to be mean, they will always be your new friend because your old ones have gone away. How many of you know what I'm talking about? But not only that, it can harm your witness in your church. Your witness in your church. Just crush us, man. Just destroy us. It harms our witness and our church. And you can see that in James chapter 3, verse 13 and 16. Let me just tell you, if you want to blow up your witness and blow up a church, let me tell you how to do it. You ready? Let me tell you how to do it. Let's put those four steps to blowing up a church. You ready? Four ways to turn a conflict, a simple conflict, into a feud. And let me tell you what, each one of us has our own desires. I have certain desires that you don't. And some of them are small, but they can turn from conflicts to feuds pretty easy. How do you do? First of all, here's how you turn a conflict into a feud. You let the angry feelings build up. Boy, just let it boil. Let it boil. Number two, you misinterpret the evidence to fit your conclusion. A lot of times I hear people misinterpret the evidence and they think every time someone repeats a habit is a personal offense against them. When all they are doing is what? Repeating a personal habit. It may be a bad habit, but it's not against you. Number three, if you want to blow up a conflict into a feud, always assume you can judge someone else's motive. That's the core. None of us can ever judge we can judge someone's actions, and they might be right or wrong, but I can never tell you the reason they did it. I can never tell you unless they tell me the reason. Number four, here's how you blow it up. Assume you're right, and there's no way that some of this is not your fault. Boy, that's the way you begin to blow up your friendships. That's the way you begin to blow up a church. That's the way you begin to blow up your family. Next, let's move on. Let me give you four other thoughts. You ready? Four ways to turn a personal feud into a corporate problem. So now I've gone from my personal feud to a corporate problem. How do I do it? Let me give you four ways. Broadcast a problem in order to gain support. What? Instead of me having a problem, person A having a problem with person B, now person A begins to broadcast the problem for the purpose of gaining support. It's not all that uncommon as the pastor to have someone call and say, hey, pastor, you mind if I come and speak to you? And so I'll say yes, and we'll come, and they go, hey, listen, here's what I want to really talk to you about. I'm really struggling with so-and-so. I go, really? And what happened? Well, this is what happened. Well, good. Have you talked to them about it? No, I haven't talked to them about it, but they continue to do it over and over again. But I have talked to several other people about it. And they recommended that I come talk to you. They've already begun to broadcast the problem in order to gain support. Then not only that, you censor the information that you do give out to make yourself look better. Isn't that what we do? If I'm in a conflict, I'm going to begin to gain support. Let me just tell you, if I'm going to tell a story, there is no way I'm coming out of that story looking like the goose. Right? We're going to censor the information. I'm not going to tell you everything I did. I'll pretty much tell you everything they did, but I'm not going to tell you everything that I did. Here's another one. Refuse to change your behavior, but always expect them to change theirs. Here's number four. You ready? Resist God's command to forgive. Resist God's command to forgive. Let me just tell you, to be dead level honest, most of the things that become from this to this, go from this to this, is something that could be easily forgiven if we were just willing to. Sometimes I am not denying some massive pain that some people have been through in their lives that is much, much harder. But a vast majority of stuff we fight about, it's a molehill and nothing but a molehill. You say, if I want to forgive someone, and if you're here today, next step, James would say, what causes all the quarreling? He would say, start with forgiving. How do you do it? Number one, you could write this down, or I'll tweet them out this week and put them on my blog. Sympathize with them. Focus on the person and not the problem. Just try to sympathize with them. They're not perfect. I'm not perfect. We're not perfect. Number two, relinquish your bitterness. Just let it go. Just let it go. And then three, expect God to change the relationship. But I want you to know, until you learn to sympathize with them and you release your bitterness, God can never change your relationship with them until you let God change you. They harm quarrels and fights and arguments. They harm our families. They harm our friendship. They harm our witness and our church. Here's the fourth area. They harm our careers. We're challenged to work. We're told to work. We're told to be good at the office. But they harm our careers, our professions. They do. What does the Bible say? Look at Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 3 says, is it to one's honor to avoid strife? But every fool is quick to quarrel. Came across an article, a research article this week from Penn Behavioral Health Corporate Services. It's just a group that constantly is studying the corporate environment, how they can improve the corporate environment. And I ran across this article on conflict and quarrels and fights in the workplace. And here's a couple of the studies that they showed that sometimes managers spend between 30 and 43% of their time simply mediating conflict between employees, 30 to 43% of their time. Now you say, well, that's less than half, but let me tell you what, the emotional energy a manager has to go through to, man, just to navigate that and try to reassign team and employees if they've constantly got a battle, what an incredible struggle that is. Listen to this. When it comes to the employees, up to 65% of performance problems with many people come from strained relationships in the office. In other words, if they are always fighting at the coffee pot during break time, don't expect them to maximize performance when they're back at the desk, because what are they still thinking about? What was said at the coffee pot in the seething anger? Went on to say, if you add those two numbers, the emotional drain on a manager and the lack of performance, they point back to perhaps as much as 50% of all job losses could at their core be tracked back to conflict, quarrels, and fighting. That's a lot. So don't be that person for your own good. Don't be that person at the office that is always in a battle. That's your takeaway for the week. Your challenge this week, here it is. Write it down. It's real simple. Last week it was long. Write it down. Everybody get your pen out. Bury the hatchet. Not in them. Just get over it. If it's not a monster problem, let it go. Keith, you want to come out and let's sing that verse, that chorus that we've sung several times together. Let's go ahead and stand up. Stop the quarreling and fighting. Continue to tame the tongue this week. We're going to sing this, Lord, I give you my heart. And then we're going to say, God, we're going to not quarrel. We're going to give our tongue. Our altar team, you come on down here. We always want to do this. If you're going through a struggle or a battle, you need someone to pray with you, don't head to the door. If you need to head to the altar. Let's sing.